Yes, I'm happy to have been invited here by Tony on my tour to the US. And I'm going to speak about, well, the subject is there. And if it's right, it's rather interesting. And if it has also good chances to be wrong, because it goes against everything you know up to now. So we'll see where this goes to. But somebody in this audience will be in shock in a few years. I hope it's not me. So I will shortly recall what's dark matter, but you probably know. I will speak about modeling in virial equilibrium, in particular galaxy cluster. And I will then derive the mass from this and some other properties and even the name. And then I will speak about a few problems that show up also. Why, what's going to mess up in nucleosynthesis, what's happening, why do I have this virial equilibrium, and connection to reionization. Well, the point of, you all know there's dark matter, but the point is, according to me and to collaborators of mine, that there are two types. Well, first of all, we know the total mass of the universe has some 4 to 5% of baryons, some 20 to 25% of dark matter, and some 70% or so of dark energy. And the galactic dark matter was realized by Oort. Oort is a physicist from the Netherlands, from Leiden. In 1931, he was looking at our galactic plane and the motion of stars perpendicular to it. And they went faster than he could explain by the present mass, by counting stars. So he assumed there would be more mass, which you don't see, and which can explain these big speeds. And the point that I probably will not get to is, but the point of, actually point of my collaborators, is that this mass is made of machos, which means, it's a horrible name, massive astrophysical compact halo objects. They could just have said planets, but that's probably less sexy. Actually, they are just planets. And that's the point. If there's a theory of hydrodynamics, which is completely unknown, but it's just hydrodynamics of structure formation, and I may come to it at the end. And that predicts that there are Millie-Brown dwarfs, which is basically objects of Earth mass, which consist of baryons. So this is part of the dark baryons, because actually when I say 4 to 5% of baryons, you may know that the stars is only 0.5%. So there's quite a bit missing. Now some part of the missing mass is in intercluster gas, and this is X-ray gas. It has about 10 to the 8 Kelvin. I will come to that. Some people think that all the missing mass, so what's here except this 0.5%, by the way, this 0.5% is also an upper estimate, it's maybe more 0.3%, but anyhow. Some people believe that it's all, the rest is in cluster gas, we don't. We believe that there's also a good part in these, let's call them planets. And they are the galactic dark matter. Now, there's also clusters of galaxies. Also have dark matter. This was realized by Zwicky 1 year later. Zwicky was, I think he was in California. He looked at the rotation of these galaxies. So now we don't speak about stars, but about galaxies around each other in a cluster. And they also went too fast, so there had to be more matter. And he called that dark matter. So he came with his name. And he also supposed that the best way to look at it is to look at the lensing effects of these clusters. And this was really ahead of time, of his time, but now it's completely common to do that. And my point is, of everybody's point in fact, is that this is formed by what's so-called WIMPs, weakly interacting massive particles, so basically elementary particles. And there's of course a whole debate on what this could be. And the best chances, according to most people, is that this will be supersymmetric particles. Now the point is, of my point is that the dark matter of galaxy clusters is non-baryonic. They are these new particles, new or old, and these are planets. So here, nothing new here. And this is an important point to keep in mind if I don't forget to come back to it later. So anyhow, it's not machos or wimps, it is machos and wimps. That is message one. So here's a galaxy cluster, the one that I will study, a very nice lot of galaxies over there. And if you see, you see some curves, some parts of the Einstein ring. And this is the best studied cluster, at least it was the best studied cluster up to a few years. Now they can do, of course, everything better. But this one is very well documented in literature. It's rather nearby, it has a mass of the order of 10 to the 15 solar masses. The luminosity is also something 10 to the 11 times. There are not so many baryons, a few percent. And there's this Einstein ring. And now I'm going to show you a few more photographs of the same. This is just an enlargement. And here you see again this Einstein ring. And you see all kinds of pieces of rings here. And if you look at this for a moment, then it is as if you are looking towards light that comes through a crystal ball. Everything goes in circles. And that is my point, that the dark matter which is hanging around this galaxy cluster has completely the same effect as a crystal ball, or like the glasses that the older ones among us and myself also need to get the light in the right way in your eyes. So here are some more, another thing, but now in false color, this blue or this violet, it gives the density of the gas. This, what I said, this intercluster gas. So this photograph has three things. It has the galaxies, it has the rings, which tell you how big the dark matter component is, and it has in the blue color the density of this intercluster gas. And this is hot stuff because it's 10 kilo electron volt or 10 to the 8 Kelvin, really hot. And you might wonder why it can be so hot. And I'll come to that. And this was last summer in Paris, a nice meeting. And they had pleased me, and probably they knew I would come because they put this on the... And here's another cluster. Now it's another cluster, but this is after the last repair of Hubble. And you see here this big chunk. And there are many of these clusters and big, and you see also everything goes in circles. Huh? And this is the lensing effect. And actually this is strong lensing, there's also weak lensing. Weak lensing is here, you don't see circles, but if you look at the galaxies behind this cluster, and you look here, then because of the lensing they get an average rotation. So. If far away, then the angles are just random, but here they get a deflection in the same direction. So if you measure the statistical deflection here, you can also find the amount of the dark matter density here. And what you really measure is the dark matter density, the dark matter mass along your line of sight. That's what you really measure in this lensing analysis. So let's do a bit of theory. There were some people doing this before, and I extended on that. Actually, I started myself, I realized these references later. But so let me just assume that dark matter comes from fermions. And fermions non-interacting. So they are only in their common gravitational potential. Now, fortunately I was teaching this, that's probably how I got to it. So you have a fermionic mass, and they have a degeneracy, G. And G can be 2 if you have particle, antiparticle, 2s plus 1 if there's a spin S, and a number of families if you have that, it will also be there. And then the assumption was just to look at equilibrium at some temperature T, and then the density is this integral over the Fermi-Dirac distribution. Well, of course, you have some chemical potential that you have to fit later. And this U here is the gravitational potential. And M times U is the gravitational potential energy at position R for a particle of mass M. And this is, of course, the integral over the mass density of all the other matter there with the Newton term. And this term here is just a constant which is chosen such that this object is zero in the origin. And this potential satisfies the Poisson equation. I assume spherical symmetry to keep life simple. And then you have this equation from the Poisson equation. And now you have a closed problem because rho was depending on u. And the rest we assumed that was known. We assumed that all the things were known. So rho depends on u, and u depends on rho here. So you have a closed problem. And this is basically the problem, well, not exactly, that was treated by this later paper. Not exactly, because they also assumed cold dark matter, which I will not do. But as I mentioned, it's not only that thing. In this galaxy cluster, you have dark matter, but you have also galaxies and gas. So let's do a bit of modeling for them. I assume hydrostatic equilibrium, which means that for each of these three components, P prime over rho is minus gm over r squared, and m is the mass included in a sphere of radius r. And here I assume the ideal gas law, because the densities of the galaxies is of course very small. You have, say, 1,000 galaxies in this huge cluster. And the gas, their density is higher, but not extremely high. It's still a dilute gas. So you can just assume the ideal gas law. And if you put that in, then you find that these densities are just Boltzmann distributions. And if I told you you have something at some temperature, then you expect a Boltzmann distribution, of course. And now I make the assumption of virial equilibrium, or what I want to say, that all velocity dispersions are the same. So actually this whole stuff, all these galaxies and the gas and the dark matter, they have more or less the same velocities. And that is what you often have in astrophysics. Which means that this velocity dispersion squared, so it's a velocity variance, for the, what is that? Oh, for the galaxies, this capital G is the galaxies, it's the same one as for the gas. And if I express it in those temperatures, then T over M is this velocity, it's a one-dimensional velocity dispersion. So half mv squared is kT over 2. So there are no factors 2 and 3 in this relation. So this velocity dispersion is the temperature over the mass, and it will be the same for all these three components. That's more or less an assumption. It could fail, it could work. We can just see what it brings. Of course, this will always be an approximation to what is really going on in that cluster. But let's see where it goes. So now everything is defined. So you can go to dimensionless radius, dimensionless potential. You have your thermal length scale. It will be the usual expression. And there will be a characteristic scale coming in. And if you do that, you can write your dark matter density as this degeneracy factor times the mass over this thermal length to the third power, as usual, and then some polylogarithm which comes out from integrating out the Fermi-Dirac distribution. And you will end up with a Poisson equation in dimensionless variables. Here is the Laplacian of the potential. Here is the density from the dark matter. And here you have your two Boltzmann distributions for the galaxies and the gas. And now I have, in front of this phi here, there's the factor in front is just 1. Huh? This was my normalization. And I had this assumption of these that these virial speeds were all the same. And that means that this, for the galaxies, also have this beta equal to 1. So they have e to the minus phi, both of them. For the gas, it is more complicated because this gas is not, it's a composed thing. There are protons, there are electrons, there's helium, and there are some metals. What cosmologists call metals is everything more heavy than helium. So there's some stuff there. And if you then do the calculation, you get that this beta of that object here is 0.15 under this assumption of 30% solar metallicity. The basic thing is why you don't have beta 1 here is that all these other only these two components add to the mass, but all the components add to the pressure, and in particular also the electrons add to the pressure. Now, what they observe in the lensing is the integrated mass along the line of sight. So if you have your density, you just look in your direction and all the mass you see there you pick up, and that is what they observe from the lensing profiles. And then what they do, they average this over inside a sphere of radius r, and they also average it outside the sphere, or outside this sphere, and inside a sphere with some fixed value. At least one of the papers I will use in a moment is doing this. So you have some inner average and some outer average, where this Rm is just some fixed value, which is for once and for all fixed. So if you do that, then this average, it will be related to that one. And what I will show in a plot is then the difference between these two. So it's a contrast function between the average inside and the average outside. And if you do this algebra, you see that everything is related to this function. So if you know that, then it's fairly, fairly simple to go on. Now I had this model with this differential equation. I'll put it up again. It was here. So I have to integrate all this density, and then I can use the differential equation in that calculation, and that's very helpful, because then I get a simple expression for this function I need. So this sigma is some amplitude times some function, which is here given in the solution of the differential equation. And I need this at r over this r star, where r is the real distance, and r star is a characteristic dense distance. So this can now be done. And you can look at these data points. I have two sets of data points from these people in 1995. And these that are these blue points, and these black points are a recent paper, 2007. And I fit my model to it. I have, let me think, 1, 2, 3, 4. I think I have 5 variables to fit. And well, the fit is working well. And the question is, of course, what do we learn from this? And so, let's move on then. Now, the first thing was of interest, of course, is the mass. I had this mass, it was something. I didn't know what. And I have to calculate it from the fit. And here is the formula you get if you do the exercise. So it is, what is here? 2, well, a constant. Here's this G bar, which is the number of modes. But it's the number of modes available in the cluster. These particles are there, and how many modes do they have? Then here's H bar. Here is A, the amplitude of my fitting. Here's Newton's constant, and here is this characteristic scale. Now the interesting thing is here, I have A to the 1 over 8. So if I have an error 10 in my A, then this M has only an error of 1.25 or so. So this is very useful to have such expressions. So I'm going to insert these numbers, and I will use the reduced Hubble parameter. So I take the real Hubble parameter, I divide by 70 kilometers per second per megaparsec, because basically people think that it is around here, within a few percent. So this thing will be close to 1. So it's here, I have to take the square root. Well, why do I introduce this? I'm using these astrophysical data. And of course, these astrophysicists don't know the Hubble parameter, so they express their results in so much times a certain power of the Hubble parameter. And therefore, it is sticking in this A and this R star, and it will come in my mass. Then I have this G. Well, this also shows up in a certain way. It was already there, minus 1/4. I put the 12 there because I like that. And what I keep is about 1.5 electron volts. And in the fit that I made, I have a small statistical error. Well, of course, this is probably an underestimate because there were many assumptions that I cannot really rely on. But it's a nice small error. 2%. But now the important point here is actually only this part here, electron volt. Because this mass is in the order of electron volt. And also the earlier papers came to estimates in the order of electron volts. Not so sharp as I have, but they did come with electron volt estimates. So if this story is true, then the previous theories for dark matter and the searches, they will all be wrong then. So either this is right or not. If this is right, the others are wrong. That's how it works. So these kilo electron volts, mega, giga electron volts, tera electron volts, they are all completely incompatible with this theory, because I had to take this power 1 over 8. I may be wrong by a factor 2 or 3, or would be a lot, because it's 1 over 8. So either the model is completely wrong, or the other approaches are completely wrong. Of course, future will have to show us what is the reality.
What was the chemical potential and temperature again?
Yeah, they also there.
Yeah.
Oh, the dimensionless chemical potential is about 40. What do I have here? Alpha is 38.4.
What is alpha? Sorry.
It's the chemical potential of a kT.
And what is T?
T is 0.04 Kelvin.
0.04 Kelvin?
Yeah.
Why is it so low?
Yeah. That's nice. You may know that we all believe that the neutrino temperature is 1.95 Kelvin. What we read in the books is that the neutrino temperature is the 1.95 Kelvin, because it comes from the Fermi-Dirac distribution, which remains valid in the expanding universe. But then this is, of course, the momentum temperature, and this is this. But the neutrinos are not relativistic. So the kinetic temperature, kinetic temperature is half mv squared, and this will not be that one. It will be something like that one times kT nu over mc squared, because this is v squared and v is there. So this one is much lower. This is about 10 to the minus 4 Kelvin. So this is the one I should look at. It's 10 to the minus 4. And what I have, this T in the cluster, it will be 0.04 Kelvin. So it is more than this one. So it is not that low. It could not be lower, of course. It could not be lower. Because this is the temperature it would have if all the neutrinos, or sorry, all the particles are still spread out. But what I see here is that this is mainly dark matter, so it is highly concentrated on the cluster, and far away there's almost nothing. So dark matter is very inhomogeneous because it brings this lensing in the clusters. So I can look at the cosmic matter fraction, because you know for neutrinos how many neutrinos there are. It is 56 per cubic centimeter for each degree of freedom. And these G's is now the cosmic G. It is the number of occupied modes. So for instance, for neutrinos, this is just 6. There are 6 modes for neutrinos. And for other particles, it could be 0.01 if you want. It depends on which particle you have. So with this density and the mass, I can divide by the critical density and get the cosmic matter fraction of this dark matter. And this will again be something, some factors, depending on this. Here's G, that's the number of modes that are present, that have ever been created. Here's the number of modes that is present in the cluster that need not be the same. And here's Hubble constant, and then I have 0.18 so much, so about a small 20%. If these factors are 1, then there's about 20% of this dark matter. So actually it's a lot, provided that these factors are close to 1. So the question, what is this dark matter particle? And now, we can all come with our guesses. We could think of axions, but actually axions don't do the job, because I did the fitting and I did it for a fermion, and bosons would not fit. If I had bosons, I could not get this. I looked at it and you get this line and it really doesn't fit.
So
at least the Bose-Einstein distribution doesn't fit. Therefore, I do not consider axions. Gravitino, neutralinos, xenos, they would have very heavy masses. I have very small masses. Moreover, they would probably be early decouplers, and then this would be small. And then the whole thing would be small in any case, would be of the order of 1%, but we expect 20% or so or more. If you take WMAP 5, you have 21% with some error in it. And you see here's 0.21, here's 0.19. So it works if all these G's are equal to 12. That's what you see here. And this brought me to neutrinos, because what can we have? We have 6 degrees of known neutrinos, the active neutrinos. But if I have only the active neutrinos, I would get, here would be 6 over 12, with half. This would be 12 over 12, because in the cluster, all modes are available. The directions get scrambled, and I have just 12 degrees of freedom to drop my matter in. So the active neutrinos would have half of this stuff. So it would be a small 10%. And that is much more than which is allowed by the WMAP analysis and other kinds of analysis. But these people assume cold dark matter, and then they look how much place there is still for neutrinos.
You made a very strong statement. So all bosons are ruled out, you said.
Yeah.
Because you made this fit. Now,
yeah.
This fit, I missed it. It was some of the data. It was one particular gravitational lensing?
One cluster.
One cluster. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, when you fit to the bosons, you use the Bose-Einstein?
Yes, the Bose-Einstein distribution.
Isn't it all condensated? The temperature comes up to be very low, like 104
at the altitude. The bosons don't fit, so I didn't look for a temperature. It would be horrible. It would be horrible compared to the data I have, and I didn't continue with it. So let's move on for this. So if I assume that there are neutrinos and I just look at the neutrinos we know, then I would get 9% of dark matter. And this is already conflicting everything we know, because the estimates are basically that it could be 0.5%. Because the dark matter would come from cold dark matter, which means heavy particles. And these particles are very light. It would be completely different. So there's already a conflict here. If my assumptions are correct, then there's already a conflict with standard theory. And then let me go on. Let me just try to get this 20% of dark matter. And that is possible if I assume that the right-handed neutrinos are also present. They're also there. They do nothing, because they have. They don't interact. We know that interactions are left-handed, but they can just be there and be sterile. So these are called sterile neutrinos. And I have only one mass, so they should have the same mass. And then, if I have sterile neutrinos, I would have the number of degrees would be twice the 6. It would be 12, because they can be particle, antiparticle, left or right-handed, and there are 3 families, so that makes up for 12.
Does that mess up the Z decay width?
No, because they are sterile. They are sterile.
Z doesn't couple.
It doesn't couple. No, else I should have stopped already. There are many moments where I could have stopped. Mm-hmm. But I can tell you one thing. Let's go back, because
so I... you're saying that 1 dB right-handed is not good enough?
No, I need them here. I think I need them. But there are other problems. I'll come to that soon. But I should tell you that I started this research with only these blue data points. And I got 1.65 electron volt for this mass. And then later I realized there are more data points because 95 is long ago. And then it was not this 1.65 but 1.45 electron volts. Just to give you an idea of, you can see that if you have only this part, there's not so much fitting you have to do. This is much stronger, this piece. So that is maybe an indication of the true error I am doing in the model. Now, of course, there are neutrino oscillations, but actually these are rather small effects because they would be of the order of a milli electron volt or less. So what the picture I have here is that all neutrinos have the same mass up to small deviations in the milli electron volt range. Now, there are a few surprises here in the model already. If I look at the thermal length, this lambda, which was in my formulas, the Breuer length, I get 0.2 millimeter. And that is the thickness of your hair. And this is enormous for a quantum particle. But the point is, this mass was so small. So that's why it can be so large. And the temperature, I said it here already, it's 0.044 Kelvin. It's also rather low, but it's not zero. And the typical...
How can it be so cold when they would have been in equilibrium in the past?
Yes.
How did they get so cold?
But the point is, if they were still uniform and in equilibrium, they would now have this 10 to the minus 4 Kelvin.
Why would you... I don't understand. I mean, the coldest other thing is a few Kelvin. I mean,
There's a So the average of P is KT and this T nu.
Wait, why is that they're not relativistic? So why is the average of P KT?
Well, I just integrate over this thing.
For non-relativistic particles?
Now the point is, this is a quasi-relativistic distribution. The momenta have the distribution as if they were relativistic. This comes from the Boltzmann equation.
Oh, wait, sorry. You say you have a distribution of your x and p, and the.
So.
Sorry, their temperature is much less than their mass, but they have a relativistic distribution.
Yes, that's the point. So they are non-relativistic, so I have p squared over 2m. So this is kt nu times another kt nu over mc squared.
That depends on the equation above. I don't understand what it means to say that you have a relativistic relation for P. That's not the Boltzmann distribution for a non-relativistic particle.
Well,
this
is the solution of the Boltzmann equation for free streaming neutrinos.
Oh, is that right? So yeah. You said they have it.
This is in the books.
Okay. So they're actually not in equilibrium.
On top. But there was some time when they were just still free streaming. And at that time, they also had this distribution. And their kinetic temperature, which comes from here, would already be this expression. So there is a kinetic temperature and there's a momentum temperature. And what people in the book discuss is only the momentum temperature. And since they don't know the mass, that doesn't make much sense to speak about the kinetic temperature. But it is lower because it's this extra factor of non-relativistic physics. And so, to come back to this point, this kinetic temperature would be of the order of 10 to the minus 4 Kelvin, and in that respect, this is much larger because it's 0.04. So that's a small subtlety of this stuff. So these speeds are indeed non-relativistic. It's some 500 kilometers per second. And the density can be enormous because in the center of this cluster, it would be a billion in a few cubic centimeters. So in your pink, there would be a billion in it. Now, a billion for dark matter particles is a lot, but a billion for atoms is not a lot. There are 10 to the 24 in this finger. So everything is relative. So let's see what they do. So here are my theoretical curves for these densities. Here is the distance, and here is the quantum degeneracy parameter, which means the number of neutrinos per cubic thermal wavelength per degree of freedom. And as we know, when this thing becomes equal to 1, you go over from the quantum regime to the classical regime, in the sense that here you have effects of the Fermi-Dirac distribution and the Pauli principle, and here it would just be classical. And this crossover is at a nice point. It's about 500 kiloparsec. So the distance, 2r, the diameter, is 3 million light years. And this is quite a distance. And what I have from this, if this analysis is really true, then we have such a big quantum object in this cluster. And all these clusters will then have huge regions where you have this where the Pauli principle is important and pushes the other ones out, because there cannot be too much in each other's neighborhood. And here we had this one already. And what is 500 kiloparsec is on this scale is about from the center to here or so. It's really a huge region, even on these photographs. Now, I also said there would be this gas of hot protons, basically, and alpha particles, and then there's not so much more, well, electrons, of course. And this gas has a temperature in the order of 10 to the 8 Kelvin, or 10 kiloelectron volts. And now I was just looking at my data, and I looked at what would be the temperature I know for these neutrinos now, and I can then calculate for the other components by putting its mass there. And I looked at the temperature for the alpha particles. First I did for the protons, I didn't like that too much. I did for the alpha particles, and I got this 10 kiloelectron volts. So, maybe this is a bit fortuitous, but in any case, I'm somewhere in the proper ballpark. If I take the ratio, maybe there could be a factor two wrong in my analysis here, and also in how I use the data and so on. But this goes the right direction. It's this is in the order of 10 kiloelectron volt, and that one is. So this works nicely together. And here is the mass of the gas, the logarithm as function of the logarithm of the radius. And I had been doing my fitting, and which means basically I fit here the first point, and the rest was not fit because I had used this 30% solar metallicity. Everything was fixed then. And you see the line I get versus the data points. And these first points are rather well described without doing any effort. And the other points, here I have too little, but probably the temperature is not constant there, and I should do a better analysis.
So again, I try to understand this temperature related to the confusion before.
Yeah.
The key nu is the momentum temperature. You say
yeah.
Because the neutrinos
yeah.
are there's two temperatures,
yeah.
momentum and energy.
Yeah.
So where does this come from? The alpha.
Oh, no, no, sorry. No.
This scale.
No, sorry. This T nu is the temperature in the cluster. And the momentum temperature here was in the expanding universe.
You wrote that as T nu also.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, you're right. But this is not that T nu. This is the one that is which you read in the books, Weinberg, to mention one, or Copeland Turner, or whoever. This is the one that it gets. This is this 0.04 Kelvin, which I had here. I had not in the cluster. So let me call this T nu in the Abel cluster, T nu A. And that's the one that goes here.
And it just scales by the mass.
Yeah, this was my assumption of ferial equilibrium. I can dish it up again. It was here. I had assumed that all these temperatures went with their masses. So I get it from this relation. But this basically means that they all have typically the same speeds, more or less. So where was I? So this works not bad, in particular because it came out without doing much fitting. And here the temperature of the gas drops to zero. And therefore, the theory assuming a constant temperature doesn't work well. And of course, more work should be done here to get it right. So now comes time to do some ideas. So the cluster radiates in X-rays like a star radiates in light. And the radiated energy is supplied by contraction of the cluster, just as it happens in stars. Stars radiate and they also contract a bit. And the contraction provides the energy for radiation. And as you know, it's a kind of sliding equilibrium for the stars. They just contract so much that the amount of light they want to send out is just fitting. And the same is, I think, the same thing is happening for these clusters. And then, so in other words, this X-ray light that is sent out by this hot gas, I think it comes from the contraction of the clusters, which means that it will always be the same until the cluster is completely different. But for a long period, it will remain the same. So this avoids a problem that other people have, namely other people say, well, yeah, this gas has to cool down, but it's still rather hot. And I don't have to explain that it cools down. It just stays rather hot because of this connection to the neutrino temperature in the cluster. And so this radiation actually helps to maintain this virial equilibrium. It is as if you have a bucket full of water, and but you still have water coming in, and it's just flowing over. It's and then the level will always stay constant. You're just on one side in and the other side out. So now come a few nasty questions, because I have been assuming that these sterile modes were also occupied. At least I had to assume that to get to 20% of dark matter. If I would be happy with 10%, I would not have to do this and would have a better life. But all the papers I read, they speak about 20% of dark matter or more. So let me see how this can continue. So now I assume that I have doing standard model physics, and so I'm at the right place. So I'll have a Dirac mass matrix, 3x3, as usual. But there will also be a Majorana mass matrix. And this Majorana couples not psi with psi bar, but psi with psi, or the charge conjugate of psi. But this Majorana is a small term. Let's forget that for a moment. We just have this Dirac mass, and their value, as I've got from the fitting, is about 1.5 electron volts. And then I saw a nice formula. I didn't see it. I cooked it up. I took the product of the Yukawa coupling of the electron times the electron mass. And if you do that, you have a nice formula here. It goes with the that's twice the electron mass there. And the outcome is 1.4998 electron volt. Now this is rather close to here. And I still had this Hubble constant in my prediction for the mass. So I can just fit the Hubble constant such that I get my mass exactly there. And if I do that, I find a Hubble constant of 74.4 kilometers per second per megaparsec. And this just completely coincides with the best Hubble constant of last year of the group of Ries and the newest set of supernova. Now, yeah, this is a complete amazement. It's too beautiful to be true, but still I wanted to tell you.
That's just numerological.
Well, that's numerical, but this is nice formula.
The electron, not the muon.
Well, then I'm far out. Huh? Then I'm far out. No. Okay, this is a game. This is a game. It, of course, has no meaning till we know the answer, because this may lead to a complete new modeling of mass, of fermion masses. Well, as I say, it is too good to be true. But the big surprise is that my Hubble constant becomes even better. But again, I really do not know what is the... I have no idea what is the systematic error of my whole work. So This is just interesting if it is true. So now this Majorana mass term, it couples a neutrino to its charge conjugate, so two neutrinos can annihilate each other. Lepton number is not conserved. This is well known, because many people are working with these Majorana masses because they work with a seesaw mechanism to produce sterile neutrinos. I take the same Hamiltonian, Lagrangian, but they assume that the Majorana term is big, but I assume it is small. So I'm in another corner of the phase space, but it's the same model. Now the point is that there was at least one paper discussing that if the Majorana mass is larger than, say, 0.001 electron volt or so, that then right-handed neutrinos are created in the period between 200 MeV and 1 MeV, which means after the quark frees out and before the neutrino frees out. Sorry. Yes, that's a good idea. You're completely right. Gave this talk already quite a few times and didn't notice. Yes, you're right. The error is that I always do it the other way around, but in time it goes this way and then I messed up. So for T between 1 and 200 MeV, so this is the quark freeze out and this is the electron positron freeze out. And then these neutrinos freeze out also. So what does this Majorana term do? It can, of course, allow what is called neutrinoless double beta decay. So now I have a nucleus, and the nucleus, I have two neutrons, and they both decay at the same time. And they both send out an electron that goes out, and a proton that stays there, and they send out an antineutrino. And these antineutrinos, they are annihilated by this Majorana term. So it's just not coming out. And then these electrons are in opposite direction because of momentum conservation. And people are looking for this for these events already for a long time. And there is an upper bound for this Majorana mass involved in this process. This Majorana mass should be less than 0.2 electron volt or 0.7. There are some uncertainties here because of they don't know the nuclear matrix elements very well. But most people believe it's an upper bound, but there's one author who claims that there's an observation of this value. For me, this would be a bit too strong. I would rather believe that this is an upper bound, but new experiments are being done. There is the Gerda experiment, which is running somewhere. And we'll see in 1 year or so what comes out of that. Then, unfortunately, I now have fallen in the trap of Fred Hoyle. He had clearly explained that neutrinos have something to do with nucleosynthesis. Because if I have more neutrinos, I have more expansion. There's just more mass. And now comes the trouble. If I expand faster, then neutrons have not time enough to decay. So I end up with more helium. And that's not a good thing to do because there are measurements on this. But maybe it is solved if there's a neutrino asymmetry. In that case, you have more neutrinos and antineutrinos. It's this stuff here. And because you have more neutrinos, you have more reactions for the neutron to decay. And these two things compensate each other, the faster expansion and the more decays. And then you can fit those stuff. And so maybe I can escape here, but this needs more work. This needs a serious investigation, but what I did here, I took one set of data points from literature. It was Steigmann, 2005, but he has also 2008 data. But actually what I could do is use this asymmetry, this psi, this parameter, just to put the helium-4 value that he had on the value of the W map. Because he had this, but maybe there was an asymmetry, and Maybe it should lie there, and if I do that, then this deuterium moves a little, and lithium moves a little, and about helium-3 we don't know so much, so it doesn't do so bad. But actually this deserves also a much better study. So, now then I had this ferial equilibrium. Now why would there be a, that's of course I had a Fermi-Dirac distribution, but the question is why should there be such a distribution? It could be anything. I have a dynamics. Why should there be Fermi-Dirac distribution at the end of the dynamics? And there is an argument by Lindenbell. It's called violent relaxation. And he was looking at star clusters, and he was looking at the time it took for two stars to collide and then to equilibrate the cluster. And he realized that that would be much larger than the Hubble time. So obviously, the cluster looked equilibrated, so something else had to be going on. And he realized that what you have is relaxation in a time-dependent potential. So the potential is just the potential energy of all the particles in the cluster. And this is time-dependent. And if that is the case, then each particle can change energy, because energy is conserved in a potential. But if the potential is time-dependent, it changes. That's Newton's law. And if it changes, it can equilibrate with the whole cluster. And that was his idea. And in particular, he showed that if the phase space density becomes uniform, there are two or three Fs here, if, then you get a Fermi-Dirac distribution. So if everything really goes nice, then I have my Fermi-Dirac distribution. So at least there is an argument to consider this. And then what I mentioned already, this X-ray distribution helps to maintain this ferial state. What do we have here? So yeah, I mentioned cold dark matter. That is the stuff that you know, and you did not throw tomatoes yet. But you may have realized that I'm completely in conflict with that. Because what I have, these neutrinos, are hot dark matter. So cold dark matter would be heavy particles, which are already clumped at redshift 1100 at the decoupling of light and matter. But these neutrinos are very light, and they at that moment they are just free streaming and homogeneous. They are there, but they don't interact because it's extremely weak interaction. They do nothing, but at a late moment they get trapped by the galaxy cluster. And that we can see again here. This typical momentum is kT, and this T is going down. So this becomes smaller and smaller, and when it's really small, they start to feel attracted to these galaxies, to the baryons. So here is this Boltzmann equation for that, and here you have zero because there are no collisions. The collisions is very, very weak. They start out free streaming, and then at some moment, when these two terms are of the same order, they start to condense on the cluster. And I do not know exactly when this happens, but somewhere between 6 and 10 or so in redshift. So at that moment, the neutrinos condense. They were everywhere. They were in particular also in the voids. And they now condense on matter. And now comes an interesting point, because when they collapse on this galaxy cluster, there was a lot of gas, and this was cold gas. But now that gas starts to virialize. And that means that it goes to this 10 kilo electron volts kinetic energy. And if you go up from 0 to 10 kilo electron volt, at some moment you pass this 13.6 electron volt, and your hydrogen will reionize. So here's a point, it's well known, this reionization. It is known that there's a lot of X-ray gas. It is not so well known how this comes about. The present theory is that there have been very heavy stars in the early universe that, of course, they had a short lifetime and would send out a lot of photons, and the photons would reionize this gas. Here there's another idea, namely it could be the neutrinos. When they condense on the cluster, they will speed up these atoms, and they will reionize because they have to go a long way. And now, my paper was out last summer, and I think in November there were measurements at redshift 7, some group, I don't remember which people that was, but what they said is that at redshift 7 they were measuring too few photons for reionization. So there is already some stress on the standard interpretation for reionization, but here's another way out. And then this hot dark matter paradigm also agrees with gravitational hydrodynamics. So that's a whole other story, and maybe I should not go into that, because of course I've now turned everything upside down. There's no cold dark matter anymore, if I'm right. And everything has to be redone. In particular, what has to be redone is structure formation after the decoupling. And cold dark matter was introduced to explain the structure formation.
So what about the CMB?
Yeah, this is some things I have more or less the position of the first peak, but I do not have profiles.
Could we go back to the previous transparency, to this Linden-Bell argument, because it seems pretty crucial, right? Because you assume the Fermi-Dirac distribution.
Yeah.
So let me try to understand that. So what he's saying is that usually we are taught in school that to reach equilibrium you have to collide particles.
Yeah.
Yep. It's not fast enough, so but instead, every time each particle moves around, it changes the whole gravitational, the potential, you say, and that the time-dependent potential.
Yeah.
Talking about the gravitational.
Yeah, it's a time-dependent gravitational potential.
So everything adjusts, and this is a
yeah,
much faster.
That's the idea, yeah.
So then you get Fermi Dirac.
Well, this is what he showed.
Oh, IFF.
Yes, he showed it. Linden-Bell showed this in his paper. He has two papers.
So why would phase-space density become uniform?
Well, that is then the good question. This is the golden question. I can tell you, he used it to explain the behavior in these globular star clusters. I can use this argument to explain the rotation curve of galaxies. It's exactly this argument. Assuming a thermal distribution, actually it is already in Binion domain, that if you have an isothermal model, you get a flattening of the rotation curves. If you know what all these words mean. And what is observed is the flattening of the rotation curves. So there is an argument why this works. And I'm just taking the argument a step further. So, what time is it?
1 minute.
A whole minute left, so no problem. This would be a completely different talk, which is basically started by my colleagues Gibson and Shields. We have a paper last December, but these people had papers in 96. There's a whole story on how now this structure formation has to be repaired. And it's actually not repair, because it's actually just hydrodynamics. And the main point is that hydrodynamics is non-trivial in structure formation. And as you all know, you never use it, and you never, it's not in the books that you read. And we think it's just overlooked. So there's a whole upside down of the story. By the way, the present approach is bottom-up structure formation. So you have a gas, you make stars, and then you make galaxies, and you make galaxy clusters, and so on. And here is completely the other way around, top down. You first make galaxy clusters, and then galaxies, and then planets, and then stars, the whole story. If you want to know, we can keep that for the discussion. Let me just put up the summary. What I did, I looked at the observed dark matter distribution of this Abel cluster. And I could explain it by thermal fermions with mass of a few electron volts. And these more heavier masses for dark matter particles are excluded. And also bosons are excluded. If I fit with the mass from there the global dark matter fraction, then if I am willing to, I can do the fit if I have only active neutrinos, I get half of the 20%, and if I say that also zero neutrinos, then they would get the 20%. And the mass is of the order of 1.5 electron volt, and ideally it would be that value. This gas temperature, which is observed, fits very well in the picture. I get high temperatures, and the gas profile also matched without doing much work on it. Baryons are poor traces of the dark matter density. I showed you three different curves, and they had all the three different profiles. These neutrinos were free streaming in the early universe, but they have flown into the potential well somewhere at a redshift 6 or 7 or 10 or so. And the point is that I think that this causes reionization without heavy stars. So this neutrino hot dark matter model completely challenges the cold dark matter paradigm, including the present explanation of the cosmic microwave background peaks. But on the other hand, this dark matter particle was not found before. The cold dark matter particle was not found. And here I have a list of about 40 experiments. Most of it have been done, and I did not put the, I mean, they had all upgrades, eh? Because there was this, the one that have, you know, about 2 months ago, a press release, they had found two dark matter particles.
2 weeks
ago. CDSM? CDMS. C, so it's alphabetic. But it's not this one, it's CDMS2. And so the list will be two or three times longer if I did all of that. Now, they found two dark matter particles, but they also said it could be background. And they may be right, or I may be right, or somebody else may be right. But for the moment, I think that they are not, have not been very conclusive. Not very
experimentalists are here. You should go talk to
them. Oh, well, are they in the
not
audience?
In this room, but in the physics.
Oh. Well, I've been in such, well, yeah, I've told this in Paris for a group of people. I said sorry, and then I walked out, and one lady said, well, you know, that's exactly the reason why I leave this field. Because this, no, not my talk, but they have been, they have been searching for 20 or 30 years and never found anything. At some moment you get tired, you know. The brave ones will go on, of course. But for instance, IceCube is only a few months ago. IceCube, eh, on the South Pole. And they have all these detectors in the ice, and they had a nice visor of letter, they saw nothing. LHC, well, we don't know. It's slowly moving up. Yeah, I think they will not see the dark matter particle. I'm telling that to those people. They are not happy to hear this. Pamela is in the sky, and Fermi, and they have a nice twist, because one sees something that the other doesn't see. And then we get long talking, and then in the end, there is no dark matter so far. And, well, of course, we will only know when the real experiment is done. And this, fortunately, the experiment is already standing there, and they are starting it up in 2012. It is called Katrin. So let me go to that one. So this is a tritium decay. We have tritium that decays in helium and an electron and an antineutrino. And you measure the energy of the electron. And then you put the number of decays as function of the energy. And you have to look at the corner. And here you see the difference between no mass, zero mass, and one electron volt. And I would be slightly to the left. And then they have to figure out that they're really sure what would have happened here, because you also have the problem that you don't know your baseline. And it's 2 to the minus 13 of all decays would have come here if the mass was zero. So it's a tedious experiment. And they have a big tank for that. Here is the tank. And it was made here. It's Munich. And this is Europe. If you don't know. I don't have... At home, I don't have to say these things. But now I ask you, what is this red line? Because now I'm teasing you. And UT is back. What is the red line? Now you are from Europe or not? No, it's not fair. What is the red line there? It's a Danube River. For Europe, it's a long river. They took it almost all because they put it on a boat. So it comes in the Black Sea and the Aegean Sea and the Mediterranean, the Atlantic, the North Sea, and here it enters Rotterdam, which is about 40 kilometers from Amsterdam, where I live. So I could have waved. And then it went up the Rhine, and it only had to come from the Rhine to the Karlsruhe, the Forschungsanlage, the previous nuclear plant and now research center. And it only had to come there, but there was a problem. There was a small village in the road. And look here, and you can go to this Katrin site, and they have movies. It's very nice. And the space between the roof and the machine was just 10 centimeters, so a hand. And if you look, you see some people taking away some trees and some other stuff which is in the way. But still, I was very surprised here, because why is this track under an angle? If I had to move this, I would never go under an angle here. And look here, it's the same angle. But then I saw this photograph, and something was looming up here. And as you see here, it's a church. And you would not want to go with this inside the church. So that's why they had to go under an angle here. So I think I should thank you for your attention.
Can you comment more on the Kodak nanorobots prospect of the CMB and the galaxy?
Well, I mean the measurements on Kodak on the CMB is there. There are these data points, and they must be explained by theory. And it is true that there's a theory doing it very well, as far as we know. There may be another theory.
Pre-screening of the hard dark matter.
Yeah. No, that is a longer story. So indeed, the dark matter had nothing to do with this. Now the baryons themselves have to do this. And now there's a question about this hydrodynamics. Because if you know, if you have any fluid, you have hydrodynamics. And what is often assumed is that at the decoupling, you can forget the hydrodynamics. And this is a misconception. You cannot forget the hydrodynamics. You have to redo the whole story. And in particular, before the... So it means you have viscosity. No. It's completely different. There's an instability. So your plasma, because we were speaking about the plasma, it has a viscosity because there are electrons and free electrons and photons. So you get the viscosity from that. And then you have to see how big is the viscous length and when does it come into the horizon. And it comes into the horizon before the decoupling. Which means that your plasma, it has to expand, but then it's viscous, it doesn't want to expand, and you get instability there. So you get clumps of plasma clumps in your you get plasma clumps and you get holes and another plasma clump. Now if you take these holes and you size them up to the present size with the redshift, you get 40 megaparsec. And this is what we think is the voids. So these holes, they were the proto-voids, and they have just sized up to the present voids. And these clumps, they have about the mass of a galaxy cluster. So galaxy clusters in this picture are made before the decoupling. And then I'm going to want to work with those people on the Stefan's quintet, if you know that. There are five galaxies very close to each other, much closer than statistically allowed. But that's not so bad. One of them has a very different redshift. So it is much closer by. And it also looks blue on the new Hubble photograph of, 2 months ago or so. But there's a hydrogen bridge in between. And however could this hydrogen bridge be there? And this is also explained by this fluid mechanics. And there are other things, because that is a whole talk. It's a very interesting field. What I said, the rotation curves of galaxies. We know that the rotation starts out small in the zero in the origin, and it goes to a constant. And Binney and Tremaine show that this could be explained by the isothermal model. If you do that, you find that it works this way. But why this isothermal model? And in hydrodynamics, you say that the Jeans mechanism, it makes clumps of matter. Some of them become globular star clusters. And in our galaxy, there are 149, so that is very few. So hydrodynamics says, yeah, but these other clumps are also there. They didn't make stars, but they are there. And if they get, dynamically make an isothermal model, then these genes clumps are the point particles, the so-called point particles of the isothermal model. So this really explains the rotation curves. It even explains the Tully-Fisher relation, which you may not know, but astronomers are very fond of that one, as a two-particle effect of these isothermal distributions. Comes out right away, even without hardly any calculation.
The slope?
Slope? Oh, I don't know about slopes. No, it's a power that. So the luminosity of a galaxy goes as the velocity dispersion to the fourth power. Because the isothermal distribution goes as with the second power, and if you have a two particle effect, you get twice the second power, which is fourth power. It's what's called back of the envelope. It comes out right away. And also, there are stories about dwarf clusters. So dwarf clusters with a lot of dark matter, a big mystery in the standard model. And in this hydrodynamics, it's rather obvious. You just have this Jeans cluster. And now this Jeans cluster, it was already fragmented in objects of Earth weight. And a few stars have been formed, say 10,000, and all the rest is still there as invisible matter, so dark matter. And it explains it right away, again, without even a calculation. So there are many. That's actually maybe the main message. You don't have to believe my what I say, but please be aware that there are many problems of the standard model. And the more photographs we get, every month there's a new problem. And that may be a point when it has to be put aside. What I will do myself, or at least with colleagues, is look at more clusters and see whether or not this comes out. It will be clear. Then they will measure the neutrino mass in a couple of years. Then it will be completely clear whether I'm right or completely wrong. It will come out, of course. So in a couple of years, things will be rather clear. But I would say, just watch the news in astrophysics, and every month they have a new problem for the standard model. 10 years ago, people said that if there was any galaxy found at redshift larger than 5, the standard model should be given up. And now they see them at 7 and 8, and will soon be 9. It's just a...
They've already seen
a 10. A 10, or that was a gamma ray burst, maybe. It's not a galaxy. But no. But how does this... Yeah, well, maybe I missed one. I was traveling 2 weeks. So I think that this standard model is completely dead. And I was not the first to think this, because my co-authors are already convinced of this for more than 10 years. One is an astronomer, the other a fluid an observer. One is an observer, the other is a fluid mechanics theoretician, applying the ideas of turbulence in the ocean and so on to cosmology.
So the
fact that
the
power
spectrum in the intergalactic medium matches that of the
cold dark matter is a coincidence? No idea. I don't know about this. But
just one last question.
Cookies. Oh, that's a danger.
let's thank the speaker again.